I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Good evening and welcome to the online London Review Bookshop for the second event in That Year Again, our year-long series of celebrations of some of the many significant centenaries we'll be marking in 2022. I'm Sam Kitchen-Smith, the London Review of Books' Head of Special Projects, and tonight it's the turn of Rainer Maria Rilke, who in the space of 3 weeks between the second and today's date, the 23rd of February 1922, produced 1.5 literary masterpieces. It started the Duino elegies 10 years earlier and completed them in between writing the two cycles of the sonnets to Orpheus. In what one of his many translators, more on that later, Stephen Mitchell has described as surely the most astonishing burst of inspiration in the history of literature. Tonight, I'm delighted and excited to be joined by Angie Malinko, poet, critic, and professor of English at the University of Florida, by Don Patterson, poet and musician, whose versions of the Orpheus sonnets were published by Faber in 2007, and by Edmund Duval, the writer, ceramic artist, who has described Rilke and his work as breading his life, for quite specific reasons that we'll come to. For the next 45 minutes or so, we'll be discussing three things, mainly Rilke and his work, and the elegies and sonnets in particular, Rilke's inspiration for our three panellists' own artistic work, and the idea of astonishing bursts of inspiration more generally. Then we'll come to your questions. Please ask them in the event chat or under the Q&A, and I'll fold them into the conversation as and when. So Angie, I thought we'd come to you first.
Okay.
You've kindly volunteered to begin tonight's conversation by giving us some of the background, telling the famous story of Rilke's very busy February in 1922.
So we've convened here tonight because on this very date, 100 years ago, Rilke came to the end of a creative storm of 3 weeks' duration from February 2nd to the 23rd, 1922. In that time, the 46-year-old composed the 64 sonnets to Orpheus, amounting to 896 rhyming lines, to which very few edits or corrections were required. He also wrote or finished 6 Duino elegies, completing the 10-part poetic sequence that had been haunting him for 10 years. That sequence came out to 859 lines in total. This coherent, musical, formally brilliant outpouring has achieved legendary status. For sheer magnitude, there's nothing else like it in all our poetic lore. It appears as a kind of miracle. And indeed, Rilke does credit outside sources, as it were. Duino Castle, a fortress set on a steep promontory above the Adriatic Sea, was being battered by a violent storm in January 1912 when Rilke, who was pacing around outdoors in an agitated state of mind, heard in the high wind the voice of the angel intoning the opening words of the elegy. Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angelic orders? On January 12th, he wrote to his friend, the owner of Duino Castle, Princess Marie von Turn-on-Taxis, on whom the to whom the elegies would ultimately be dedicated. I am writing like a madman. The voice that uses me is greater than I. And on January 16th, he wrote again of that, quote, dictation the other day called down so stormily on this Patmos, comparing himself to St. John, receiving the book of Revelation. And maybe later we can touch on the persistence of this idea of dictation among poets. So Rilke heard an angel's voice. By January 21st, 1912, he had sent the first elegy to the princess and finished two elegies and received fragments of the third, the sixth, the ninth, and the opening of the tenth. The third elegy concluded in Paris in 1913 and the fourth elegy in Munich in 1915. Rilke knew he had more work to do, yet he couldn't put himself in the right mental state to receive the angel's voice again. Until 10 years later, now in a different castle, the Chateau Musat in Switzerland's Rhone Valley. His mistress, Valadine Klosauke, who had found him this stone tower, left a postcard of Orpheus playing his lyre to the wild animals, and also a copy of Ovid's Metamorphoses in a French prose translation. Rilke, in addition, had been translating recently Paul Valéry and Michelangelo's sonnets. An old friend, Gertrude Knoop, sent him the diary written by her daughter Vera, who had died of leukemia 2 years earlier. She was only 19, a former dancer turned musician. He knew her as a friend of his daughter, Ruth. The girl's voice, describing her own dying, seemed to reach him from the beyond as much as any angel's. He received the diary in January, and between February 2nd and 5th, he wrote the first part of the sonnets to Orpheus. On February 7th, he began the elegies and finished them on the 15th. But as he wrote to confidant Lou Thelemé, no sooner was this elegy, the fifth, on paper when the sonnets to Orpheus started to make themselves heard again. And he wrote the second part from the 15th to the 23rd. When the creative storm was over, he went outside in the dark and stroked the stone of the old tower Musat as if it were the flank of a pack animal that had safely carried him across the desert. I'll conclude by reading the fifth elegy. It was actually the last one he wrote. It starts out by describing the melancholy 1905 Picasso painting, La Famille de Steltenbank, The Family of Acrobats, a painting roughly 7 feet by 7 feet, which was hanging in the Munich apartment of his friend, Hertha Koenig, the dedicatee of this elegy, when she let him stay there for a spell in 1915. It mingled in his mind with the time he saw a troop of acrobats in a square in Paris, a squalid Paris that seemed to him a city of invalids. This elegy moves from description of the painting to address, where he speaks to the children in the painting, first a little boy, then a little girl, then ends by invoking his tutelar angel. But tell me, who are they, these wanderers, and more rootless even than we ourselves, seized early on and urgently wrenched, for whose possible sake, by some never satisfied will? And still it wrings them, bends them, twists them and slings them, tosses and catches them, as if through smoother, frictionless air they drop down onto the red bare carpet worn even thinner by their eternal leaping, this carpet lost in the universe, laid down like a bandage, as if the jagged sky of city edges had wounded the earth there. And scarcely in place, upright, held for display, that initial letter from their body's alphabet, when already the grip returns, rolling them again, even the strongest, as in some jest, like Augustus the Strong at table crumpling a pewter plate. Ah, and around this center, the rose of onlooking, blooming and shedding petals. Around this pestle, this pistol dusted with its own pollen, impregnated once more to bear the feigned fruit of boredom, boredom self-concealed beneath the thinnest glaze of rote smiling. There, the withered strong man, his skin all folds, the old one who only drums now, shriveled inside his great physique, as though it once held two men, and now one lies dead in the churchyard, and he survived that other, deaf, and sometimes a bit confused in his widowed skin. But there, the young one, the full man, who might be the offspring of a neck and a nun, strapping and stretched taut with sinews and simpleness. Oh, you all, given once as a plaything to a young grief, something to entertain it during one of its long convalescences. First you, who with the thud only unripe fruit know, fall 100 times daily from that tree of intermeshed movements, tree swifter than water, traversing spring, summer, autumn, all in a few moments, fall and rebound from the grave. Sometimes, in the briefest pause, a loving look tries to rise in you and reach across your seldom tender mother, reach across to your seldom tender mother. But it disperses over your body, whose surface quickly absorbs that shy, scarcely attempted face. And again, the man claps his hands for the dismount, and before a hurt can reach your always galloping heart to become clear at its origin, the burning in your footsoles overtakes it, driving into your eyes mere physical tears. And nevertheless, blindly, the smile. Angel, oh, take it, pluck it, that small petaled herb of healing. Create a vase, preserve it, place it among those joys not yet open to us, a delicate urn. Let an ornate inscription praise it. Dubricio saltat. The acrobat smile. Then you, my sweetest, you whom the most ravishing joys leapt over soundlessly, perhaps your fringes feel happy for you, or the green metallic silk that covers your firm young breasts feels endlessly pampered and in need of nothing. You, market fruit of equanimity, ever placed differently on the scales of a wavering equipoise, a public thing amid shoulders. Where is that place? I carry it in my heart, where for so long they were still not able, still fell away from each other like mismatched animals trying to mate, where the weights are still heavy, where the plates still topple from the staves that spin and spin in vain. And suddenly in this effort-filled nowhere, suddenly the ineffable point where the pure too little mysteriously converts flips over into the empty too much, point where the complex equation achieves zero. Squares, oh town square in Paris, infinite showplace where the modiste Madame Lamour loops and binds the restless roads of the earth, unending ribbons, designing new bows, faddish frills, flowers, cockades, baked fruit, all falsely dyed for the cheap winter hats of fate. Angel, suppose there's a place we don't know of, and there, on an indescribable carpet, lovers blazoned all those feats never mastered here. The bold high figures of their heart leaps across space, their towers of pure pleasure, their two ladders that stand leaning only against each other, with no ground underneath, trembling, and perform them before the circle of onlookers, the innumerable silent dead. Wouldn't these then throw their last of happiness, hoarded for a lifetime, kept hidden for a lifetime, unknown to us, eternally valid, before a pair now truly smiling at last on the quieted carpet?
Thank you, Andy. That sets us up wonderfully. I'd like to bring Don and Edmund in now as well, so that we're all on screen. I'm going to ask questions to each of you in turn, but I hope that if you feel moved, if the spirit moves you to answer anything in particular that I'm asking someone else, please do just interject. Angie, there's another quote by Stephen Mitchell who he says, when life occurs at this level of intensity, biography turns into myth. And I mean, reading this in the context of maybe some of the other sort of monuments of modernism and modernity that we're marking this year, I can't just help asking myself, what's going on here? Why is this story like this? Why is the work like this? Why is there a connection with inspiration that the piece that you wrote in The Nation in 2009 is more in line with what happened to Cadman in the 10th century,
yeah,
when an angel visited him, or indeed Orpheus himself. Why is this so mythic, and how are we to read its mythicness?
Well, on the one hand, I want to say that poets still do rely on this mythicness and on myth and on inspiration. And, for instance, James Merrill with his Ouija board, writing an enormous epic, Changing Light at Sandover. There was Yeats, there was the Cocteau film, Orphée, where Orpheus gets his inspiration listening to the radio, a modern update on inspiration. So I don't think it's something that's in the past. I think we're still living it. But I also think that Rilke was kind of a transitional figure to modernism. He was born a little early, I think, 1875. So maybe more along the lines of Yeats and Cavafy, for instance, or Wallace Stevens, sort of transitional figures into the wilder or radical modernism.
That makes sense. And I mean, speaking as both a critic and a poet, do you encounter the idea of inspiration in the same way with those two hats on? I mean, do you recognize aspects of what you identify in the work of poets that you're writing about as an essayist?
Yes. I think that I have a strong sense of vocation. So I think that poetry and religion or art and religion are closely related. Not that I hear voices, but I do think that my experience of craft is one of experiencing a mysterious collaboration with the material. So if I set myself up with a constraint, I'm actually working with this impersonal medium language that has a mind of its own, and we work together to create the poem.
Michael Wood in an LRB piece about Rilke that has the very memorable title, "His affairs with women were intense, literary, and dominated by the word soul." He sort of creates a dichotomy between the sort of silliness of aspects of perhaps of this myth, but certainly of the way that Rilke lived his life, the almost kind of impossibly fey and kind of aesthetic life that he lived and relationships that he had, with the intense seriousness that immediately becomes apparent the minute that you start to read the work. Is that a kind of dichotomy that you're conscious of, and is that unusual to have? I mean, people are obsessed with poets' biographies often without reading their work, but I feel like the disconnect that Michael Wood writes about is quite singular in this case.
Well, I you know, I'm jealous of Rilke. I'm jealous of that, of his ability to, you know, make that space for himself to do the writing. And you know, maybe most of us don't have the stomach for it, the stomach to disappoint so many people. But I do, in my heart of hearts, I think that, you know, we just don't want to think about the ways in which we fail to live intensely and feel intensely, and that he's kind of a dinging reminder of, you know, our failure to live life to the fullest.
I think this would be a good moment to bring Edmund into the conversation. Edmund, you, as a lot of our viewers will probably be aware, you have a personal connection to Rilke through your grandmother that you wrote about in The Hare with the Amber Eyes. And I'm wondering if perhaps we could kick off a conversation about Rilke and biography and personal connections with a little bit of a reading from that chapter, and perhaps one of them.
Absolutely. We might come back to the pathos of his life, and also also the kind of granular work. Actually, I kind of really want to go back into sort of into the work of being a poet, not just the sort of Vatic inspiration bit, but actually the work bit. I think I really want to not let that disappear into the storms over Duino Castle. But yes, absolutely. My grandmother, Elizabeth Efrisi, and Rilke. It's quite a good story. You must change your life, Rilke wrote in his poems on the archaic pulso of Apollo. Could any instruction be more thrilling? But it was not until my grandmother Elizabeth died, aged 92, that I realized how important Rilke was to her. I knew that there were some letters, but they were a rumor, a muffled roll of splendor. It was when I stood in front of the statue of Apollo with his lyre in the courtyard of her family home, the Palais Prussi, on the Ringstrasse in Vienna, on a winter's afternoon, and haltingly tried to remember Rilke's poem, the marble glistening like a predator's coat, that I knew I had to find them. Elizabeth had been given an introduction to Rilke by her uncle, Philip Pitts Schei, who'd helped Rilke when he was stranded in Germany by the outset of war, the First War. And after the war, Pitts had begged permission for his favorite poetic niece to send some poems. Elizabeth wrote breathlessly to Rilke in the summer of 1921, enclosing Michelangelo, a verse drama, and asking whether she might dedicate it to him. There was a long delay until the following spring of 22, a delay occasioned by his finishing of the Duino elegies. But then he wrote back a 5-page letter, and they began to correspond, the 20-year-old student in Vienna and the poet in Switzerland. And they correspond and correspond. They start with a refusal. He resists a dedication. But he continues in his letters, I'd be interested to see what you're writing. And they write to each other for 5 years, 12 letters of 60 pages from him, interspersed with manuscript copies of his recent poems and translations. She sends him translations of Valéry. She sends him the sonnets to Orpheus in a fair copy, and many volumes of verse inscribed with warm dedications. And if you stand in a library and look at Rilke's collected works, the yard or so of volumes, most of them are letters, and most of these seem to be to titled Disappointed Ladies, to borrow John Berryman's penetrating phrase. Elizabeth was a young poetic baroness, and so completely not unusual amongst many of his correspondents, but Rilke was a great letter writer, and these in particular are wonderful, exhortatory, lyrical, funny, engaged, a testament to what he calls a writing friendship. And they have never been translated and only recently transcribed by a Rilke scholar working in England. And in these extraordinary letters, including one he sends a month after he finishes the Duino elegies and the sonnets to Orpheus, he writes about Valéry, the years when Valéry didn't write poetry at all. He writes about Paris and how the recent death of Proust has affected him and makes him think of Paris again, makes him think of working as Rodin's secretary. Has Elizabeth read Proust? She should do so. Just think what it might have been like to get that letter from him. Imagine seeing his slightly right-sloping, looping handwriting on the envelope from Switzerland as the post is brought into the breakfast room in the Palais, your father at one end opening the beige book catalogues from his Berlin booksellers, your mother at the other with a feuilleton, your brother, your sister arguing quietly. Imagine slitting the envelope and finding that Rilke has sent you his sonnets to Orpheus, a transcription of a poem of Valerie. It is like a fairy tale. I cannot believe it belongs to me, she writes back that night from her desk, pushed up against the window, looking out over the Lindenbaum onto the ring. So that's my connection with my poetic and not disappointed grandmother, who in my childhood, I send poems to her, like all children send poems to their grandmother. And then, like a good proper Jewish grandmother, she sends them back corrected. I look at my two poetic professors in the thing. She sends them back and she tells me to read Rilke. And I do. And she gives me Rilke for my 12th birthday. She gives me a copy of the Duino Elegies, which is a pretty damn good 12th present to give a 12-year-old boy. But I didn't know. I simply didn't know the extent of this correspondence. Until she died. And then it became clear that this was, you know, yet another letters to a young poet, another complete correspondence, because when Rilke dies, his widow sends back all her letters. So we now have this complete correspondence, including things from February 1922, which is pretty damn cruel.
And I mean, Edmund, you're work as both a writer and as a ceramic artist. I'm interested in, I mean, you've identified Rilke as a sort of thread running through it. And I wonder if the inspiration that he, the inspirational role that he occupies in your own work, the way it's mediated by the personal connection, I wonder whether it's because of almost something tangible. Because you know you knew your grandmother and she knew him and the kind of aura of it, or actually is it because in some respects your grandmother is as a kind of normal person interacting with someone who seems so mythic makes it practical somehow?
It's none of that, if I can say. So it's certainly not about the aura. And it is wonderful to have that inheritance, and it's wonderful to have that kind of that oral connection with Rilke. That there's no difference. You know, there I am with my grandmother. She knew Rilke. Extraordinary. All that stuff. That's amazing. But that doesn't make you write, and it doesn't make you make. So what I learn from Rilke is by reading the damn man, by reading him. But what I get from him is extraordinary. What I get from him, of course, is work, the work of being a poet. And you have to imagine, as I've been making pots all my life, and at 17 I was apprenticed, and I read this extraordinary letter from Rilke very, very early on, where he talks about the fact that the things that matter to him most, can I just quote you something? I often wonder whether things unemphasized in themselves haven't exerted the most profound influence on my development and my work. The encounter with a dog, but the hours I spent in Rome watching a rope maker, who in his craft repeated one of the oldest gestures in the world, as did the potter in a little village on the Nile, standing beside his wheel, was indescribably, in a most mysterious way, fruitful for me. The Rilke, as you know, his poems are full of making, of the hand, of touching things. His senses is as much as we're talking in this extraordinary moment about Orphic inspiration, it's also absolutely about tactility, about holding objects and then seeing them migrate and transmute into other things. So if you're a potter making mugs and desperately trying to make a make a living and struggling to find an identity, this idea of poetry in itself being a kind of making where one thing becomes other, becomes poetic through repetition and through craft, is hugely, hugely significant. So that's where it comes from. I love my grandmother, but that actually is from the work itself.
There's a brilliant line from the essay Angie wrote about this, which also links it to Rilke's own apprenticeship, if we can call it that, working for Rodin. The line is, Rilke, whose fame thrives on the legend of his creative outbursts and angelic dictation, learned from Rodin that daily labour is necessary preparation for the moment of insight, which I think is a really fascinating way of thinking about the work, which is to say, there's always essentially a kind of connection between work and inspiration, but in some ways it's a kind of preparatory work. Does that ring true with how you conceive of making things in a kind of Rilkean spirit?
I'll take the phrase Rilkean spirit, actually. I'll own that one. Yes, it does. It does. And I mean, you know, there's no question, but when you're reading the Elegy, or even more so when you're reading the Sonnets to Orpheus, that extraordinary, extraordinary body of work, that you know that can only happen if you have spent 30 years writing poems before. You know, there might be all kinds of extraordinary power of being in this space where you are inspired, where, and we must talk about inspiration, but you cannot write sonnets if you can't write poetry, if you haven't been working on poetry for a very long time before. And actually, you know what? It's the same with teapots, damn it. You know, you can't actually start making huge installations which are about place and about loss and about lament if you haven't actually spent hours and hours and hours trying to get things off the wheel. So, you know, he's right when he says that by standing watching a rope maker, you begin to understand something about form, and you begin to understand what can't be expressed through craft. And that's the interesting space where this begins to happen.
I wonder, I fear that you might not like this analogy, but I wonder if something of the idea of danger that's so specific to Rilke's sense of art, and it being, you know, essentially the edge of human experience, and the stakes that Angie talked about, I wonder if in some respects the kiln is a sort of quite a useful metaphor for that. Essentially the idea of closing the door on something and opening it again, and, you know, whatever you could have done, 95% of your work might have exploded.
You're absolutely right. It is the essential image at the heart of ceramics, which is that you do all this stuff, and then there has to be a process of making it other, about which you have no control. And so there is that handing over to something else, and after doing it for 50 years, you know quite a lot about what might be happening, but actually you seriously have to still open up that kiln, and things go wrong, and that is absolutely, things break, that is absolutely part of I'm not being torn apart by mine ears like Orpheus, but things break, and actually it is that process which is the interesting bit, you know, and always will be.
Let's take that as a basis for moving on to Don. Don, I wonder if you feel that element of risk, without necessarily the kind of ready-made metaphor of the kiln. And also it occurs to me that maybe you have more of a sense of that risk than other poets, perhaps, because of the fact that you're a musician and a musician performer, and sometimes I believe an improvisatory musician. And so, but potentially there's a kind of precarity within that side of the work you do, that might help feed into this conversation. Does any of that ring true?
Excuse me. Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, or rather, I'd say there are useful analogies. But live musical improvisation has precisely the opposite relationship to time that poetry does. I mean, jazz is basically a tightrope, you know, with humiliation on either side. So you have to pay absolute attention to what's going on around you. Whereas poetry, you can fix it. I mean, the risk in poetry is publishing it. You know, it's therein lies the potential humiliation. You know, I'm not too sure what the risk is. You know, as long as I can still fix it. I suppose the risk, you know, sort of, you know, to take the Rilkean line, is really is what kind of confidence are you prepared to arrogate to yourself? How seriously are you supposed to take this? You know, and what I take from him is that you can take it very seriously indeed. That's not to say that I don't think there were times when Rilke took it too seriously. I mean, I think the elegies strike me that way. I mean, that's this kind of prog phase, and I prefer the sonnets to Orpheus in a way, you know. And I mean, even compared with, you know, sort of, you know, the class of 92, you know, I mean, Eliot looks like Benny Hill compared with the Rilke of the, you know, of the elegies. But, you know, I just want to tickle him in the elegies. And I should say that I was, you know, when you were talking about, I remember that I made a version of Archaic, Torso of Apollo, and I did it totally straight. But I changed the last line to, "You must lose some weight," which I thought was hilarious. But my editor felt differently, so it reverted to the, you know, the better than the original. But there's something about him. But what I love about the sonnets is that he I think just through the very structure of the sonnet, he dials back on that, you know, and also I think sort of, you know, because that inspired moment that we're talking about was such a high frequency broadcast, he needed to slow himself down a little. I actually find that the elegy is very difficult to read. They're orthogonal. They have a kind of geometry that doesn't fit easily into my head. If I read them before I go to sleep, I don't sleep. Whereas there's something about that oracular outburst that he uses the sonnet form to kind of make his own interpretation of himself, you know, and translate it into, you know, that high risk activity into something actually useful that has proposition and syllogism and argument, and that actually can probably be more reliably translated as well for that reason, you know. Whereas the sonnets, you sense, just because you read, you sort of eight variant and actually mutually exclusive translations of any passage of the elegies, you feel that the elegies are working in that last percentile of idiomatic fluency where that kind of poetry takes place, and maybe they are locked in the German, which is the cliche about the elegies, you know. In a way, the sonnets are not, because the sonnets actually all have a kind of paraphrasable argument and proposition, you know. And it's interesting because the sonnets are the less risky aspect of the two projects here, I think. Where the elegies suffer from that risk is they're very, very difficult to translate and maybe impossible, I think.
I'm keen to hear a couple of your versions, but just to tee that up, I wonder if we could talk just briefly about another kind of risk, which was the point at which you sort of decided that the exercise of translating in this way, this kind of loose way, was something that you were going to turn into a whole book, and in so doing enter the contested thicket of Rilkean translation. And you know, there's a line in Angie's piece about the fact that you can Marjorie Perloff line, I think, you can translate the first line of the elegies in nine different ways and none of them convey any of the meaning of that first line. I mean, was that something that you sort of entered willfully, or was it in itself a kind of inspiration to treat it so loosely in what can sometimes be such a kind of sacred space?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to treat it as a sacred space, you won't get anywhere, you know. But then again, my project was very different from that of a translator, because I'm just making versions, you know. So my professional motivation was non-existent. I just, you know, it was entirely selfish. I was curious as to what the sonnets could teach and what Rilke could teach me as a poet and what I could learn, you know, through that process. But as I say, the versions are not translations. So, you know, just I'm barely a monoglot, you know. So, I mean, these are all versions that were triangulated from, you know, the 45 other versions that have been made of these poems that already existed. I mean, I can read the German sort of, you know, just sort of passably well. But in some ways, that's worse than nothing as far as when it comes to poetry, you know. But no, I mean, I did it because I had suffered my first, if I'm being completely candid, suffered my first serious bereavement. I was thinking about death a lot. Angela sort of referred to the fact that there does seem to be a kind of, there's a difficult relationship between poetry and wisdom literature, you know, but I do think it's a subset of wisdom literature. I think it hasn't done too well on that front over the last 120 years. You know, there aren't that many great sequences that you can point to as working in that area. Maybe four quartets might be another obvious candidate, but certainly in terms of poems that engage with being and death and what it means to be human and what it means to resolve the paradox of your own ghosthood, one's own foreknowledge as a human of one's death and how you live within that paradox. You know, there are very few other poems that address it so explicitly. So that was the reason that I wrote it, that I attempted it, you know, and it is just a version. It's not in any way faithful to anything other than the subjective impression of the truth I was receiving from him. So it's a further interpretation of an already oracular text. There is no doubt a simplification of that, you know, but I had to make sense of it for me because those things were important to me at the time. So it was purely, and also it was something to do with the sonnet form and the fact that, you know, the way that he works, there's a thing about death and time, which is death structures time retrospectively, you know, and that means that you can approach time as a rhythmic thing in your life only because of death. You know, and that goes for the ages of man, years, weeks, minutes, seconds, but also things like sonnets and line and, you know, and form. You know, it's about predicting the repetition of a moment, you know. So anything to do with rhythm, this is going to sound really Scottish and Calvinist, it's kind of already death infested, you know. It's just like I was curious to, you know, to be working, you know, sort of in the sonnet with death hanging over the entire project, in the way that it inevitably does in the sonnets, and this resolving figure of Orpheus is the one approach that can bridge the double realm that we have to inhabit.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Well, that sounds like a great introduction to reading one or two of your versions, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure. I won't do that. I'll read. There's a wee poem called "The Ball," and Rilke, as we know, is really good on dead children. It's one of those ones. I think he wrote it for with a cousin of his in mind who died at an early age, but. You know, and there are these touches of terrible kind of empathy that run through the sonnets. I'm not sure that Rilke had any compassion, you know, because he was a narcissist. But narcissists do empathy really well, you know, which is kind of different. But the way that translates into poetry, I think, is really interesting and incredibly touching to me anyway. So I've barbarously titled the sonnets, but hopefully uncontroversially, because it's just a neutral kind of rubric that I've given to each point. The ball. What happened to that little brotherhood, lords of the scattered gardens of the city? We were all so shy. I never understood how we hooked up in the first place. Like the lamb with the scroll that spoke, we two spoke in silence. It seemed when we were happy, it was no one's. whose ball was it? And all the anxiety that last summer that melted in the scrum. The street leaned like a stage set. The traffic rolled around us like huge toys. Nobody knew us. What was real in that all? Nothing. Just the ball. Its glorious arc. Not even the kids. But sometimes one already fading stepped below it as it fell. And I'll maybe just read the last sonnet in the sequence, which seems to sort of tie all up in a very Heideggerian sort of way, I think, you know, which I've called Being. But this is quite close to Rilke. Silent comrade of the distances, know that space dilates with your own breath. Ring out as a bell into the earth from the dark rafters of its own high place. Then watch what feeds on you grow strong again. Learn the transformations through and through. What in your life has most tormented you? If the water's sour, turn it into wine. Our senses cannot fathom this night, though be the meaning of their strange encounter, at their crossing be the radiant centre. And should the world itself forget your name, say this to the still earth, I flow. Say this to the quick stream, I am.
I want to bring in audience questions quite soon, but I'm also conscious that you probably have things that you want to ask each other. And so I want to give you an opportunity to do that. If you want to think about that just for a second, there's a line of Edmund's that I think is really interesting in the context of all three of your work, which is when Edmund writes, I'm turning real encounters into dried flowers. Self-critically, vis-a-vis the experience of reading his grandmother's letters and seeking out a certain kind of knowledge and connection through it, and I just wondered how with a point of inspiration as mythic as this, one avoids doing that. It seems to me that there is a kind of a danger of kitschness that all three of you have somehow sidestepped. Edmund.
Well, just that in a book, Don Patterson, the poet and critic, wrote that elegizing things is tantamount to poetry itself. That I think, do you claim that, Don? That actually that the elegy is actually at the heart. Or the elegiac is almost at the heart of the poetic experience. That in some way, it is talking obviously to a death, but also to, as you both have said, foreshadowing our own mortality. So how you do it without being sentimental, without being nostalgic, without being melancholic is really difficult. But you know the great line for me over the whole enterprise of trying to write about Rilke and trying to write about the people who are dead who matter to me is lacrimae rerum, the tears of things. It's, you know, you hatch that it's hard work, but and lacrimae and rerum have to come together, tears and things. But in those two words, as there are in the sonnets, perhaps not in the elegies, but as there are in the sonnets, there is something absolutely adamantine as much as there is oracular. And that's my line. That's my line on it.
Would either of you like to add anything to that?
Well, I think that the elegy I read tonight is probably the, you know, closest to talking about making, or the closest in the elegies that he comes to, you know, that thing, the tears of thing, the acrobat smile he wants to put in a jar as an herb of healing, right? And then there's the sense that the small acrobat's tears are also something that's created by by the acrobat. So there's these smiles and these tears that the acrobatics make in their movements. Does that make sense? For me, the acrobats are, you know, are emblematic of sort of the dance of making something, and then the failure of making something too.
Yeah, I think that relationship, you know, to what moves, or rather the risk of being sentimental, you know, is one that we have to take as well, you know, because that's where the real feeling is. But but there's always the danger that you're going to screw it up, you know. It always reminded me of, you know, sort of these Japanese chefs that train to cook, you know, puffer fish, you know, and they have to cut it real close to the poison sac so that, you know, you get the buzz on, you know, it's off the toxin. But, you know, if you cut too deep, you kill the diner, you know. And I always feel like we really have to, maybe that's the nature of the risk, you know, get as close to that, you know, the language of feeling and sentimentality as we dare, while just keeping on the right side of it somehow. That strikes me as the balance.
I'm reminded of one of your aphorisms, Don, in which you talk about the fact that there's always a temptation to be humorous as a poet, because the sound of stunned silence and complete boredom is more or less exactly the same. And you sort of feel like that is something that Rilke wouldn't have worried about one bit.
No, but I mean, it's interesting, you know. But on the other hand, he did take himself out of circulation. I was struck by something in Angie's piece from The Nation, sort of, you know, from 10 years ago, which he talks about him being a transitional figure and the fact that he really wasn't interested in publication at that time. And I wondered if there's something in that, you know, about feeling so, you know, sort of out of his time or ahead of his time or whatever. He couldn't trust any reception that he would get other than through personal correspondence, you know, where he was in control of of his own audience, you know. He just wasn't interested in publication at the end, you know. And I think that's a sign of if not just a transitional figure, but possibly a visionary one that doesn't even expect to be understood.
That leads into a couple of questions. There's a question from Despina, who writes, Rilke lived through the Romantic period, which expounded inspiration as core to creating. Do you think he was what Romanticism describes as a lone genius? I don't know if any of you want to pick that up specifically. There's another interesting question here that draws on the LRB archives, so thank you to the questioner here. Michael Hoffman wrote in his LRB article, Slashed, Red and Dead, "Forget the horrid and ubiquitous letters to a young poet." This is very Michael Hoffman. "Forget the sonnets to Orpheus. They," meaning the new poems of 1907 and 1908, "are for me his greatest poems and Malt his greatest book." Any thoughts on that? Do any of you want to pick up on either of those ideas?
I don't disagree, really.
Go on.
I love those books. Those were the first Rilke I encountered in Edward Snow's earlier translations. He later fiddled with them. But the poems like The Panther and The Courtesan are just, you know, perfect. They're perfect. And I think of them as, they are the thing poems. So I'm partial to this idea of poems as things, rather than, you know, transmissions through the air. So, yeah, for me, I agree.
Actually, he was a romantic, you know. I mean, I think, you know, he's sometimes called a neo-romantic, but I mean, you know, unfortunately, he might sound like a late Victorian at times, you know, but on the cusp of, you know, sort of modernism, you know, which is, you know, but the truth is, you know, while the Romantic period had a lot of lone geniuses, you know, he really was way out there in his own, you know, in such a, you know, I think it's pointless to kind of to place him within the usual chronology of schools of poetry, personally.
David asks, "The Myth Angler's got me thinking, during the reading I was reminded of H.D. and her trilogy, and then jumped to Jung and his ideas of individuation. Do any of the speakers have thoughts on the connection between Jung and the Rilke poems of 1922. I suppose that actually leads into another question of Rosemary, which is talking about Jung is obviously having a moment somewhat out of his own control because of Jordan Peterson. There's a kind of unusual sudden flowering of interest from that angle. And Rosemary asks, do you feel that Rilke will continue to offer inspiration to readers as well as poets? I suspect your answer to that would be yes, but jump in, any of you.
Yes. Can I just say yes? Can I just say yes? But also, can I absolutely, can I do the embarrassing English thing and actually say, you know, this, can you see this? Don's versions of Orpheus. I mean, I've been reading those sonnets now for 40 odd years, and this, I've had this since it came out. But what's so wonderful about this, and will and sort of press into people's hands, is that also he has an essay at the back about translating Rilke, and afterward about versions and translations, which is so helpful and interesting, and powerful. So, you know what? I think one of the great things is that you know we've all grown up in different. We've all come to Rilke through different translations, and Snow, and there's Leishman, and there's Stephen Mitchell, and there's all these different people, and there's Don doing this great work here. You know, and there will be Michael Hoffman occasionally doing these extraordinary broadsides and sort of us all away, and then we have to recover from. Sometimes, or not recover from, but actually, that's all part of it. And the point is that actually he matters. He continues to matter. He continues to find readers. You know what? The reason he continues to matter is that it is actually about really serious and complicated things that still matter to us. Human beings, about where we are. So, you know, keep on reading. We will keep on reading Rilke. There's no question about that.
Yeah, I'm just going to quickly say that really Scottish thing, which is to receive a compliment, you know, for a Calvinist is like a stab to the face. You know, thank you, sir. But the interesting thing I think about Rilke is that, you know, what's going to happen to Rilke in Germany? I wish, you know, it would be fascinating to know. I mean, I think one of the advantages, you know, sort of existing in translation in the way that he does, is he can constantly be updated into the culture of the age. Because when folk encounter him, you know, they find him worth translating again, you know, into something more immediate and contemporary. Whereas when worries that in Germany, he's sliding away a bit, especially at a time where this kind of old-fashioned kind of neo-romantic mastery isn't really valued anymore in the same way. It may not be valued sort of, you know, sort of in Anglophone culture either in the same way, but I think it's an interesting thing to reflect that we may end up with a poet that's more relevant in English than he is in German, which would be terrible if that were the case.
I was very conscious hearing both of you reading both the elegy and then the sonnets about how wonderful it is to sit and hear Rilke. And it makes me, you know, just think that because there's so much spoken poetry at the moment, there's so much listening to poetry, that perhaps there's going to be a moment for actually, you know, listening to 56 sonnets. You know, why not? It'd be a pretty good evening at the LRB.
Bear that in mind. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the Don's afterword, Edmund, because it seems to me that all three of you are. Artists who have written and worked hard on explaining your artistic practice in kind of clear and direct ways, and the interesting thing about Rilke and the observation that the vast majority of Rilke's writing was letters is that in some respects that's also true of him. There is a kind of constant metatext of explanation and exposition that exists through those letters, alongside work that sort of feels like it springs from, you know, somewhere that couldn't possibly be explained at the same time. I just wonder if any of you wanted to talk about the process of exposition and the desire to hide certain things and expose certain things as artists and also as writers.
Can I jump in here for my comrades just to say that I've finished a rather odd thing in the new year, which is my version of one of the sonnets to Orpheus, but it's a table. I took a 6 feet piece of oak, I covered it in gold leaf, and then I put porcelain slip, liquid porcelain, over the whole surface, and then I wrote the sixth sonnet to Orpheus, which Don translates as the double realm, and I call it the bright traces. I retranslated in a different way, but I rewrote the poem both in German and in English, and then into through the porcelain slip into the gold multiple times, and then covered it up like a palimpsest, and then wrote it again. It was my way of slowing my reading of this poem down. It's one of the great poems about finding things, about almost grave goods. And so it's me translating Rilke, my favorite poem of Rilke, favorite sonnet, into a thing. It's a table, it's a desk that you can walk around. It seemed to me a kind of really straightforward thing to do. And it might sound absolutely idiotic to spend all that time making a poem out of a poem. But for me, that is me doing a version or a translation. I don't care. It's working with that language about brightness and death and slowing myself down to read and hear him. So, you know, we all do different things. That's mine.
What are yours, Don and Angie?
You mean in terms of doing?
Well, I mean, the way Edmund describes it, it sounds incredibly enviable to be able to create these kind of concrete manifestations of process that can literally be lent on and seen and felt, and you know, I mean, it sounds like the dream to me as a reader, unable to engage in any ways of making that manifest, but. I think both of you are extremely good at exposition without completely, you know, undermining the miracle at the centre of the work. And I just wonder how you mediate between those things and occupy both camps, I suppose.
I think it's a more recent fallacy that you can't do both. You know, how can you read Rilke or Baudelaire, you know, or Yeats or Eliot, and not feel like, oh, I have to do this. I have to write essays. I have to write criticism. It's part of the job. And sometimes I think it's the social part of it, you know, where the poetry can be sort of protected from the social. Not always, and I wouldn't want it to be always protected by the social. I believe in having, you know, having a good laugh or conversational aside in a poem, but I think that the essays are supposed to be, you know, inviting and even seductive, you know, of the reader. Well, the poem should be seductive as well, but the essay is more social and invites you into a sort of a bigger space to hash things out. But I don't understand where this idea came from that one can't do both, or that it's detrimental to do both. No great poet has not done both.
No, absolutely. I just think it's so interesting that in Rilke's case it was so private, and then it has been made public, and that's quite a strange energy in some respects.
But he did do criticism too. He wrote essays.
Do they read
I don't know if any of us would have quite the Rilke and enthusiasm for writing about ourselves. you know, but both Angie and myself, sort of, you know, so we do write, you know, I have to say that the reason I don't write criticism is because I don't have Angie's fluency, to be honest, in the language of critical enthusiasm, which I think is the most important thing that you do as a critic, is you get someone to go and pick up another book and open it. And that's something that, excuse me, that I think you do marvelously well. I don't have that, but I mean, but that's a different thing from, to the endless morbid dwelling on the many of your own work, which I think is kind of distasteful, I think it's unseemly.
John, you said in an email to me earlier, I'm not sure how much I like Rilke, having read, having spent the day reading about him. do you feel like that is seriously off-putting? No,
I think if you find it off-putting, you're a sentimentalist, and it's ridiculous. I mean, you have to make a clear distinction between the life and the work, and it's just like you can't suddenly revise your opinion of the work because, hey, you discovered a poet's an asshole. Well, let me tell you something about poets. I mean, it's just like, it's just like, have low expectations. There's no point in being sneeringly disappointed, because you had better expectations of Rilke, from reading his work. I mean, that's absurd. But yeah, I did, after I read all those LRB articles you made me read, did come away with something like the Julian Assange of poetry. I think, okay. But I think it's so important, and it's just like, to fight your own inverse sentimentality, it's just like, these things are not related, he was a genius of a poet, The fact he was a terrible, sort of man and a terrible partner and a terrible father is kind of miserably neither here nor there.
I think we'll probably draw the conversation to a close there. It's been so interesting, and I feel like all of you have said things that that deserve a life beyond just this event, because it's really, really fascinating to hear the connection between this amazing subject and your amazing work. I'm just going to briefly talk about the other events coming up in the series. But after that, Don, I wanted to give you a heads up, but I thought actually it would be great if you could play us out with one more sonnet. So I'll give you a moment to think about what that might be, while I just briefly say that this is the second event in a series of hopefully probably about 10 over the course of the year. We began with the publication of Ulysses on the 2nd, and we'll probably end with the publication of The Wasteland in December. And in between, we'll hope to touch on Einstein's debate with Bergson, on Nosferatu, on the founding of the BBC, on Wittgenstein, on the discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb, and other momentous things that happened in this year of years. Look out for all of those events being announced on the London Review Bookshop website. We're also publishing a little book of pieces about 1922 from the archive of the LRB, many of which have specifically fed into the events that we'll be putting on over the course of the year. We'll be, for example, publishing in that book three of Don's versions that were originally published in the LRB. So please look out for those events, look out for the little book, and stay with us over the course of the year. But for this evening, I just want to thank Edmund, Don, and Angie for just a completely fascinating conversation. And I'll hand over to Don for one more reading.
Thanks. I'll just finish up with just after that conversation, one of these more thingy based sonnets. I've given the title The Drinking Fountain. O tireless giver, holy cataract, conductor of the inexhaustible one. Your clear tongue lifting through the mask of stone you hold before your face. Behind you, aqueducts vanish into the distance. From the Apennine foothills through the wheat fields and the graveyards, they bear the sacred utterance, the words that arrive forever, blackening your chin to fall into the basin that lies wrapped to your constant murmur like a sleeping ear, marmoreal circumstance. Listening rock, an ear of earth's, though she only really talks to herself. So when we're filling up our pitcher, it seems to her that someone interrupts.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.